I'm Adam Olikoff. I'm the real-time GIS capability lead for the platform, and with me I have Ricardo Trujillo, who's a developer on the real-time team. So we're going to be showing you how to archive and visualize observation data using our new spatial-temporal big data store today. So as far as the agenda, we're going to talk about why we need a new type of data store, so what problem does it solve. We'll give a definition of what observation data is and talk about the different classifications of observation data. We'll talk about the different, we'll show you a demo of visualizing observation data so you can have a tangible view of what it is as we go through the step-by-step of how to actually configure it. And then we'll introduce the ArcGIS data store, of which the spatial-temporal big data store is a part of. We'll talk about working with observation data, so that'll be the step-by-step, how do you do this yourself. And then we'll have a deeper dive, and I've got a cool Mapman prize here for somebody that can answer a tough question. So, and if you were in my previous session, you probably know the answer, so we'll see how well you're paying attention. And then we'll talk about 10.5, so what's coming new at 10.5. We do have a more exhaustive road ahead session later in the day, but we'll do just kind of a brief glimpse of what's coming at 10.5 specifically for the spatial temporal big data store. So why a new type of data store? So the motivation for this is that the 10.3 release, our real-time system could generate much more events per second than what we could store. So the storage with the relational data store, or if you brought your own SQL Server or Oracle, we could only store about 200 events per second into this. And so from a real-time system perspective, we need to be able to put this information somewhere. And at 10.3, we introduced the concept of a stream service and a stream layer on the client side with JavaScript. And this allowed us a channel to communicate real-time data up to clients. But the first question people typically asked us once they got engaged in stream services was, I need to be able to rewind this. I don't want to just see what's happening now, but I want to rewind it 5 minutes ago, 5 hours ago, 5 days ago. And so we need to be able to have a place to put this data. So that was really the motivation for us creating a new data store type for the ArcGIS platform. So at 10.4, we can ingest even more events per second. And now we have this thing called the Spatial Temporal Big Data Store. This is not a product. This is a component of the platform. So we'll get more into that in a bit. But this allows you to store observation data at very high velocities, even tens or hundreds of thousands of writes per second, inside a big data store that spans across many machines. So you can store very high volume data into this, and then you can quickly and efficiently access that data and query that data through standard techniques through ArcGIS, like map services and feature services. So any client that can consume a map service or a feature service can then visualize the data that's inside the spatial temporal big data store. So we enhance the map service and the feature service so that it knows how to query that data across all of the nodes that are in the big data store node. And that allows us to visualize data not only in raw form, but when we're dealing with hundreds of millions or billions of observations, we don't necessarily want to see that many dots on a map. So we've provided the additional capability with the big data store that if you're working with a map service and it's querying the big data store, it has the ability to aggregate data on the fly. So you don't have to go run an aggregation tool to aggregate the data. It wouldn't even make sense with real-time data because it's constantly changing. So as soon as you ran that tool, it would be out of date. And so what we provide through the map service is the ability to do on-the-fly aggregation of that data through geohash aggregation styles, which we'll show you in just a bit. You can also still render these as raw features if you like, but there's a feature threshold that you can set to say if there's more than 5 or 10,000 features, then draw me aggregations. Otherwise, draw me the raw points themselves. So this still can be streamed up to a client. And so with the stream service, the spatial temporal big data store is a nice complement to the stream service, such that if you check a box when you're publishing a stream service to say keep latest, it will keep the latest information for that stream service in the big data store. So when a client connects to with their application, instead of seeing just stuff trickle in onto the screen through the stream service, they can bootstrap the application with the current location of everything and then see the updates from there. So observation data comes in many different forms. There's moving observation data, there's stationary, discrete, and observation data that changes over time. So the moving observation data is what people typically think of when they think of a real-time GIS. But we have lots of customers that are also deploying stationary sensors that the geometry is not changing, but the attributes are changing all the time. And it's still important to have a spatial context around those stationary sensors. We also have discrete observations that happen at some point in time, and then they never, you know, they don't continue or nothing happens with them. So crime, accidents, lightning strikes, those are different kind of discrete events. So these classifications are just meant to kind of set the context for this information. You don't need to classify your data when you load it into the big data store. These are just the different kind of classifications and the way to think about your data. There's also change or growth over time, which would be another type of observation that's more of an aggregate view of something that happened in a phenomenon. So to give observations a definition, an observation is just a recording of a feature, attributes, values, and their location at some specific moment in time. So these observations are typically immutable, which means you don't edit them typically. They can be edited, but they typically aren't by design. And observations can be replayed over space and time. So as we see the picture down below, this might be the picture for the morning time. We see the afternoon time, and then the evening time, we can see a different distribution of those observations. So the way we like to think about this, well, before we do that, the observations, if they're moving, usually have a unique ID associated with them. We call that a track ID, that we can track an individual or a vehicle or whatever that moving object might be. And with that, we can, you know, see the movement over time. If we were to rewind this and replay this, you could see its movement over time, even run GP tools to reconstruct the tracks for these individuals. This is the way that we like to think about the spatial temporal big data store is it's like a giant TiVo for geospatial data. So we can record cells in a film strip, and those cells are like the plane that's on that graphic there, where we have a longitude, latitude, dimension, and then we also have a temporal dimension, which is the vertical axis. So over time, we can go back and replay the cells in the film strip, and those cells on a film strip typically don't change. You're not going to go edit those and do things. You still have the capability to do that if you really want to, but the film strip is unbounded, so it records and it records, and you can rewind and replay. But unlike a film strip, you could actually query the data and do exploratory analysis on it as well. So I could do replay this, but where the vehicle ID is this, or where it's in this range of vehicles. So you can go back and replay it and do exploratory analysis on the data. So the best way to understand observation data is to visualize it. And Ricardo is going to walk us through a few demos here to introduce you to the idea of what we can do with the spatial temporal big data store.
Thanks, Adam. So let's start exploring some of this observational data in the spatial temporal big data store. So what you guys are looking at, very familiar interface. This is the map viewer for ArcGIS Portal, ArcGIS Online. I've loaded two layers, which is consists of data from New York City. That's why we're focused on the New York City yellow taxi cab data, which we mapped on the drop-off location, XY, and I loaded a map service and a feature service in this web map. So what does that data look like? So we downloaded the data from this website, the New York City Taxi and Limo Commission, publicly available website, known in the big data community. All these files are pretty large, and I'll show you a sample of what I downloaded. I just grabbed the first 6 months of 2015, and then I just downloaded them. Here's what they look like. CSV files, about 2 gigs each one. Each one is roughly around 15 million records. So then what I did is I actually used our product ArcGIS GeoVent extension for server to load the data to simulate a streaming real-time environment. So and then we streamed it in and we loaded it into the spatial temporal data store. Later on in the session, we'll show how we actually constructed the data, the data, and streamed it in using GeoVent. But for now, what I wanted to focus on now is visualizing the data. So just to give you an idea how many records we have here, here's our map service, yellow taxi drop-off. So if I query for the counts, you can see we have 76 million plus records, right? So you guys didn't notice, look how quick that count responded, real quickly. Just keep in mind.
I guess now that we can deal with that much data, we probably should put commas in that response there.
Yeah, probably should. just to set the stage as well, I'm running everything locally on my laptop here. I have ArcGIS server, portal, the WebGIS stack, ArcGIS data store, the spatial temporal data store, and GeoVent running all on my machine. 16 gigs of RAM, 8 core. So, not bad. So let's turn it on. Let's turn on the map server to see what it looks like. Okay, cool. So the first thing you notice is it's not point data we're rendering. We're actually rendering, like Adam mentioned, geohash grids or bins. We're doing that on purpose because of the amount of the data. We can't. We're leveraging different visualization techniques so we can see that amount of data on the map and be very responsive. And as Adam mentioned earlier, as we pan and zoom around, we actually recalculate the aggregation on the fly because one of the main purposes of the spatial temporal data store is to store real-time data as real-time data moves. So as I start zooming in, you can see every time we refresh, the bins get recalculated based on your level of detail. They become smaller, so they make more sense, and the counts get updated accordingly. If we zoom to an area where there's less data, we can see that the map service actually renders the raw data, the raw features, and the raw observational data. Currently, we support simple marker symbol rendering. As you can see, it's just a simple circle with an outline. But however, that's where we can actually leverage the feature service. So that's why we have the feature service here. So what I can do is I can actually combine the map service and the feature service and apply some scale-dependent rendering so we can show the full power of the feature service and all its rendering capabilities from the ArcGIS stack. As you can see, we have to be very careful with dealing with big data. We can't load all the data on the browser. We'll overwhelm it. But that's where we can apply the scale-dependent rendering or be smart about filtering the data and showing the feature service in that way. But the cool thing I wanted to show you guys is we can actually, since this is our ArcGIS tools, we can change our symbology on the feature service and use things like our smart map rendering and, you know, create like a client-side heat map with the same data. It's the standard feature service, map service endpoint, which is really cool. So there's nothing really, you know, special about it. All your WebGIS clients can connect to it, both the map service and the feature service. So that's pretty neat. So that being said, let's zoom back out. And what I wanted to also show here is as we aggregate our data, we can start applying cool tools like our time animation. Since this is the spatial temporal big data store, we can actually apply our time filter. So as I mentioned before, this is about 6 months worth of data, and now I'm filtering it day by day. So as I play back the data, I can replay it back, and I can see that my counts are updating as we step through each day.
So those aggregations aren't pre-baked. Those are being calculated on the fly with the data.
Yeah.
So what's actually interesting about the spatial temporal data store is when we write data into the spatial temporal data store, we're indexing it by space, by time, by the combination of space and time, and we invert an index on all the other attributes as well. So you can really quickly search things on this super fast.
Yeah.
And it's opposite from what you would normally think, because if you're used to a relational database where if you get a really hairy, complex where clause, it might take a really long time to execute that. It's actually the opposite with the spatial temporal data store. The more complicated you make your query, the better index hits you're going to get, the faster response you're going to get.
Yeah. So with that, let's apply a quick attribution filter as well, and on top of our other filters that we just applied. So since this is, like I mentioned, any normal map service, I can apply a attribution filter. Let's just say I wanted to filter all the taxi drop-offs based on payment type, which is cash, whoever paid cash. And then also, let's look at the rate code. There's particular rate codes to see who went to and from JFK. So we can apply that, and voila, you can see it filtered the data. And like Adam mentioned, the more we filter the data, it's like the faster the response times are, as you can probably tell right here as I zoom in and out with the data. And then, you know, we have our attribution filter, we have our space filter, and again, we can apply just to show that our time-based filtering, and we can see now, we can play back the data. Of course, we have less data, so we're seeing the raw features now. One thing I mentioned too, we can also, we've enabled pop-ups so we can click on them too as well and get the attribution as well on the data. And then we can also, you know, filter based on maybe more days, and we can get the aggregation view as we filter. Pretty neat, huh? Back to you, Adam.
All right, cool. So hopefully that got you interested to listen to the rest of this talk. All right, so the ArcGIS Data Store was introduced at the 10.3 release, and so this is a capability that allows you to have a managed database that ArcGIS manages for you. So instead of you bringing your own SQL Server, Oracle, Postgres, you can install our ArcGIS Data Store. There's two ArcGIS Data Stores that we'll talk about in this session. There's actually three total, but we won't talk about the third one. The relational data store is Postgres. And so at 10.3, you now have the capability to go, if you have a portal — portal is a prerequisite for you to have a managed database — if you have a portal, you have the ability to install an ArcGIS data store and choose if you want the relational or the spatial temporal or both. So in this circumstance, in the diagram below, we have a portal with a hosting server, and we've installed a relational data store, which is Postgres, and then GeoEvent could be federated into that portal and write data into the ArcGIS data store. So this is traditionally used for feature services, map services, and other items. If you add an additional, if you were to go install that ArcGIS data store relational on another node and register it with your portal, it would act as a standby. So then you have a active and a passive kind of Postgres that's doing replication between each other. One is the primary, one's the standby. So if the primary failed, the standby would take over. All of that's managed for you. You don't need a DBA or other folks to do that. If you have DBAs and they want to manage that, that's awesome. But we provide a pretty basic implementation of that as a managed database inside of the system. The reason I mention this is to set the context for the spatial temporal big data store, which is very similar in concept. So you need the portal to be able to do the big data store. I get this question all the time, so I would try to remember to answer it during the session. Is there's no additional licensing for the spatial temporal big data store. If you have a portal, even if you have the minimal number of users for portal, you have the right to install the spatial temporal big data store on as many nodes as you like. You want to deploy it on 100 nodes, there's no additional licensing. It's not uncommon that these big data store nodes would be 100,000 nodes. We test it to those levels, and it works really well. The big data store is not a product, just to be clear to you. So the spatial temporal big data store is a type of data store that the platform provides. It's not a product. GeoEvent is a product. GeoAnalytics is a product. ArcGIS Server is a product. The spatial temporal big data store is a component of our platform, so it's not a product that has to be licensed. So if you have portal, you have the right to install as many as you want. And this can sustain tens of thousands of writes per second. If you went to the best practices session, we went through a performance section, and we've benchmarked one node of the big data store node to be able to handle 110,000 writes per second. That's just one node of the big data store. You typically would have at least three nodes, two at a minimum, for the big data store, and we'll explain why that is in a bit. So just like you would have replication on your primary and secondary Postgres, you want to have replication inside your big data store. So if one of the nodes fails, you don't lose data. So you want to have at least two, if not three, machines, and we'll explain why the reasoning is for three later on. The additional, if you add additional big data store nodes, sometimes we call this BDS for short, then that expands the volume of storage. So you're bringing additional machines, you're bringing additional terabytes of SSD space or whatever storage that you're choosing to use. So that gives you more volume, And when we execute queries on the map services, they would be faster because there's data being parallelized and the queries are being parallelized across the machines and being brought back very quickly. That's why we can render 70 million things, and that's just running on one node on his machine where everything else is running to. The installation experience for 10.4 is interesting. You go through a normal process like this. The spatial temporal big data store was actually built in concert and meant to be delivered along with the GeoAnalytics server product. So if you're familiar with our big data analytics tool for the platform, GeoAnalytics, this was meant to be delivered alongside that. GeoAnalytics wasn't ready to release at 10.4, but we felt strongly that we were ready to release and there was enough value to release the big data store at 10.4. So we had a short cycle to get this released. So when you install the ArcGIS data store for 10.4, there's an additional step that you have to do. So this isn't ideal, but we erred on the side of giving you the software sooner than giving you a proper UI installation experience. And so this is the command that you would run. You just, after you've installed the ArcGIS data store, you run this command, and you tell it your portal address or your hosting server address, your credentials for your portal, and then to enable the spatial temporal. So if you run that in actual command window, you would see something that looks like this. It takes about a minute. It's pretty quick. And that just registers that as a big data store node that's going to participate in that big data store cluster. You can go verify that by looking in your admin API. You can see a new type of data item called NoSQL databases. So underneath our big data store, the technology we use is Elasticsearch. So it's no secret we're using Elasticsearch. If you search for Elastic in my name or Elastic in Esri, you'll see all kinds of presentations we do at Elastic conferences and other things as well. So if you want to know more about the technology, you can find information there. But this is a NoSQL database cluster, and if you click on the item here, what you'll notice is that there's an area for machines down below. So if you had five machines registered, you would see those five machines participating in that array of machines down there below. So that registers with that. At 10.5, we've properly given you a UI to do this experience, so you have to kind of bear with that until we release 10.5, but it's just one additional step that you have to do. At 10.5, you get this nice interface where you can say which data store you want to install, and then you don't have to run that command anymore. So working with observation data, I think the best way is really we like to just show live stuff. So Ricardo's going to walk us through like the step-by-step of how did he actually accomplish what he showed you before, how did he bring that taxi data in, and how did he start to work with it?
Thanks, Adam. Okay, yeah, so this is a great segue. So I downloaded that taxicab data to demonstrate the spatial temporal data store. So there's our taxi cab CSV file once again. What I did is what you were looking at here is the ArcGIS Geo Event Manager UI, and this is where we can configure data feeds. We call them inputs and outputs or data sinks. I pre-configured the input, which is this yellow taxi in. And that's what I named it. But in GeoEvent, we can configure many different types of inputs. This particular one is focused on watching a folder for new CSV files. And it will just read every file one by one, parsing the data as text and constructing geometry based on what I have configured here in the UI. One thing I wanted to note, at 10.4.1, this particular input got enhanced so we can read big data. So we added two parameters here, is the max number of lines we want to read per batch and how often we read. So basically I told it read 1,500 lines every second so we don't overwhelm the processing engine downstream and we don't lose any data as we process the files. This is important when you're dealing with big data because if you tell it, read 10,000 lines every, half a second, you're just going to start losing data as GeoEvent tries to compensate for too much data there. One other thing I wanted to note too is we have our what we call the GeoEvent definition, which is our schema, which is I pre-configured this yellow taxi schema, and I can show you what that looks like here. If I click on the site tab, we have our pre-configured GeoVent definitions. This is what the yellow taxicab data looks like. I went in here, created fields according to the data dictionary from the website, and configured them accordingly here. And I added an additional field called geometry. Why that's important, because if we go back to the input, we want to construct our geometry from those XY fields. Since this is CSV data, we were telling this input to say, yes, construct my geometry, and this is the X field, and this is the Y field here. And then the last thing I did is I provided a proper date format, because, you know, every data can have their own date format, so that way we read the dates properly. So once I have my input configured, now we can start creating outputs, or so we can click on the output tab here, and we can just click on the add output. At as Adam mentioned, as in 10.4, we actually added two outputs to the ArcGIS Spatial Temporal Big Data Store. One of them is the add features, which is the appending features, and then the update features, which is basically keep the latest observation based on a unique track ID or a unique field. That's the big, it's the only difference between both of them. So for what we want to do, what I did to load the taxicab data is I selected the add. When you select the add, again, very familiar form screen, those of you who are familiar with GeoVent. So the first thing I'll do is just name it something meaningful for us. So I'll just call it taxi out. And then we select our GeoVent definition so we can tell it that we're conforming to this schema. And then we want to publish or write the data to what we call a data source. A data source is kind of the equivalent of like a table in the spatial temporal data store. So right now we have the one that we have the 76 million records right now, but for demonstrations, let's create a brand new one so you guys can see what the workflow is for that. So there's a button right here called Create Data Source. We just click on that, and that actually pops up the Create Data Source dialog. We did our best to try to fill out defaults for you to optimize the writes and the reads that as necessary, but I'll go over a few of these, and then Adam has a couple slides on some of the other, some of the rest of the parameters that I'll gloss over. So let's name this yellow taxi demo. And then, yes, it's point geometry. I'm going to leave the replication factor, number shards, object ID options, and rolling data option as is. Let's create a map service and a feature service. And then let's set up a display field for the map service feature service. I'm going to give it something meaningful like vendor ID. This is to help our web clients to select a display field. This is the parameter we mentioned earlier about the feature threshold. It's defaulting to zero, meaning always show the aggregation bins. But as we set up our demo, I'm going to set that up to 5,000 so we can show the raw features when we zoom to an area that's less dense. I'm going to skip over the geohash style. This is kind of a 10.5 sneak preview. When we get to that section, we'll talk about this geohash styling tab. Aggregation rendering. So this is kind of where we can control the display of those bins that we saw earlier. We have different styles, and then after we configure this data source and this map service, I'll come back and we'll tinker with these settings to show you the different options we have. So styling. Just at an overview, we have the grids that you saw, and we also can do ovals. I'll show you guys that in a bit. This is kind of neat. We have the aggregation method. As I mentioned, we're just doing aggregation based on feature count. But if we really wanted to, we can actually do statistics on an attribute field. So we can say, don't aggregate based on just pure counts. I want to know what is my total payment type or total fare. Or average or min max, so that's the type of statistics we can run on the data. So I'm going to leave it as count as we had it in the demo. Also, the labels, we can turn them on and off, just simply checking that box up. And then we can apply formatting of the label as well. Many different options here. I'm going to go ahead and add the 1,000 separator as we had before. Bin size, this is something we can also tinker with. Sometimes maybe you just want a finer grain bin so you can see more where the higher densities are on the map, or maybe you don't. Maybe you want more of a summary. So this is where you can play around with the bin size and pixels. For the map surface we just saw earlier, I increased it so we can fit the labels properly. So I'll increase it back to 25. LOD offset, it just means that every time we zoom in and out within the map, we calculate your level of detail automatically based on your map width and height and your extent. What we can do is we can tell the map to override that and say, add an additional level of detail, so show me more detailed bins as I zoom, or if you set a negative number, you can say, show me a larger size bins, regardless of where I'm at and what map requests I specify. So we'll tinker with that too as well. It's easier to show that option. And then here's your coloring ramp. You can just specify your colors and min and max if you want to exclude ranges. So I'm just going to set it up with the purple so it pops out on that gray base map. Yes, I know that's a lot to go through. We'll come back to that screen. Feature rendering, let me just mention this is our simple marker rendering here, our simple styles. We have circle, cross, diamond, square, you know, your typical simple marker symbols and your options for that. So I'm just going to go ahead and pick purple for that to match our previous map service. And the last thing is the time info. This is to give web clients hints about your time data. So I'm telling it, yeah, when you activate the time animation, you can step through it in day increments. So this is what I'm doing here. You can specify it more. Since you'll probably know your data, you can change that option right there. So after that, I'll just hit publish. And then as we publish, the GeoVan is going through and creating the necessary structure in the spatial temporal data store. We call it a data source. And we also are publishing a map service and a feature service and the appropriate portal items to go with that. And once that's done, then it returns back to the output screen and it actually selects my data source ready to go. So last step I'll do is just save it. And now I'm ready to receive data to my output. So we have our input, and now we have our output. So let's connect them together so we can start the data flow. So we'll have to create a GeoVent service for that. And we go to the GeoVent service tab, and we just simply click on the add service. And let's call this taxis. And then we'll hit the create button. And here we open up our service designer, where you can drag and drop inputs, outputs. You can add processing steps in between, filters, and so forth. I won't go too much into that, but I'm simply just going to pass through the data from the input to the output for now. And I'll just hit publish. And once that's completed, we are ready to start our data stream. So let me go back. Before I start the input, what I wanted to do is let's go back to our map service here. So we do also have a management page to manage the spatial temporal big data store, and we'll come back to this page as well. But you can see here's our new data source with map services and feature service. Let me click on that link. It actually launches the ArcGIS REST endpoint here. And I'll open up that map service with the ArcGIS Online Map Viewer. I'll log in. And then I'll apply the same base map, and we have no data. Just wanted to show you there's no data now. So let's also apply a refresh rate. So I'll modify my map and add a refresh interval so we can see the data streaming live here. Okay. All right, so There we go. So now the last thing I'll do is I'll start my input, so it'll actually kick off the file reader and start reading in the CSV files, like I mentioned before, one by one, making sure it throttles the data in at that 1500 events per second right there. And now as we switch back to our map, there's our data. There's our data coming in. And then there's our, as you can see, the aggregation counter updating every 6 seconds. So pretty cool, right? Yeah, so then it's just like I showed earlier, I mean, except we're just loading the data now, so we don't have the same amount of volume. But if we leave it, probably a few hours, we'll get there. cool. So now, I talked about all those aggregation styles. I wanted to, while we load that data, let's play around with some of those styles so you can see the differences between the different maps we can render. So keeping that same map service, the demo map service, I can click on the button here in the Manage Spatial Temporal Big Data Store page, and I can copy the map service. You don't necessarily need to copy map services. You can just edit it and edit your rendering styles. But for demo, so we can switch between them, I'll just copy the map service.
What's interesting in the big data world here, too, is typically with a map service, you go to ArcMap, put your data in there, publish it, and then you'd have the data as part of the map service. So if you wanted to render it a different way, you'd have to publish another map service, put the data in it, publish it again. This data is way too large to try to do that, so this interface allows you to have n number of map services or feature services against the same thing with different rendering styles and other things, but it's referencing the same data. That way you don't have to package your data more than once.
Yeah. So this one, I want to create smaller bins. So I showed you the bigger bins. It's kind of to cover the label. But what I want to do real quickly to show you the LOD offset is I'm going to set that to 1. And also remove my labels and see just by doing that how do our bins look. Just simply doing that and now hitting the publish button, it's just going to create, like Adam mentioned, another map service on our hosting server here, and then we should be able to see how that looks like in comparison to our previous map. All right. There goes my CPU fan.
There we go.
All right. Yeah, thank you for bearing with me. This is all on my machine. And so, yeah, cool. Here we go. So that was our previous map. So let's see if we can open the smaller bin map. Let's open that one. All right. Okay, log in. All right, so let's zoom in here. Okay. So that's kind of the same level there, I think. You can see this one has the labels and the bigger bins. This one has the smaller bins. You can see now where the density of the taxi cab drop-offs are, right? You can see it more at a higher scale there. So that's one different style you can tinker with. I wanted to show you another one. We have the ovals that we mentioned earlier. Let's show how that looks like. So I'll do the same thing. I'll copy this map service, and then I'll set the instead of grids, let's look at ovals. But I'm also going to make them smaller ovals. And one cool thing about ovals, we expose this size percentage. So I can de-emphasize the smaller, less dense aggregation. So I can say, don't render them at the usual 100% size of them. Just do 50% of the actual size. And actually overemphasize the higher counts to say 300%. That's kind of neat there. And I'll show you what that looks like just by tweaking those two parameters there and changing it to ovals, removing the labels. We'll see what that map service looks like now.
It'll probably take a minute to publish. So is there a question while we're waiting for this to publish? Yes.
This looks like a lot of the map services there for visualization of
Yeah, so the comment was, can I... Yeah, so the comment was, I could use this as an overlay for other data? Certainly, yeah. And the map service actually has full queryability, just like a feature service does, too. So you could constrain it with where clauses and other things as well on the fly. So the bins are based on a geohash. So geohash is a kind of well-known grid system around the world, and they're kind of rectangular. When we talk about the work that we're doing at 10.5, we'll show you that we actually have a proper square-sized bin. So if you want exactly a certain size, you can do that as well as hexagons and other things. We'll show you that at 10.5.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a good point. And one thing to mention too, as part of that question, is this is a regular map service, regular feature service. So anything your clients can do with the map service features, you can do it here. At 10.5, we want to expose the aggregation counts back on the feature service. So say, don't give me the raw features when I query it. Give me the actual bins, right? I think that's part of your question. So I think at 10.5, we're trying to expose that.
Yeah, it's already done. So at 10.5, you'll be able to ask a feature service and say, I want a level of detail aggregation response as opposed to raw feature response.
And with the counts and everything.
Client-side draw heat maps and things like that. That's when we showed the plenary demo, that's how the heat maps were changing on the fly. So,
So look how different this map looks now with the ovals and the de-emphasize of the less density grids or ovals. And you can see... that spot right there really pops out, right? So if we zoom closer, those of you that know New York City might know where this is at. And if we turn on imagery, Madison Square Garden, right? Makes sense? Cool. That one's cool.
Is that your list?
I got the statistics. One more. Do one more?
Yeah, you guys want to see one more?
One more? Okay.
So let's aggregate by something other than count now.
Right. Something other than count. Yeah. Let's try to get this one real quickly here. So let's do stats here. And yeah, we've been always showing feature counts. So let's do statistics now. Okay, let's do something maybe like total amount, which is the total fare amount of the taxi cab ride. So do the average of all my... taxicab fare amount. And then I'll just modify the label. I'll just add a dollar sign in front of it and remove the decimals. I'll leave that with the larger size bin and the label so we can actually see them. And I'll publish that. Okay.
Any other questions while we're waiting for it to publish? Yes. Yeah, so the question is, can I aggregate by general polygon? So that's something we're working on. So we're trying to get the performance good enough that we can do aggregation by polygon, even if you have tens of thousands of polygons. So it's on the cutting room edge, maybe on the floor for 10.5, but we're working on it. So we're also working on server-side heat map, map service generation as well, so that we can do the heat map on the fly. Another question in the back. Yeah, so the question is, how do I get the spatial temporal data source? So you have to have Portal in order to have a hosted managed database, and spatial temporal data store is a hosted managed database. So you have to have Portal to run the spatial temporal big data store. It's a business decision, not a technical decision. So I advocated otherwise, but lost. Yeah, so the question is, do we think that that'll change so that if I just have server, I could use the spatial temporal data store? Give that feedback to the server folks on the island. So that's what I advocated for, but that was not the business decision that was made. Yeah, good feedback. All right, you got some
figures? Yeah, so just to show this last map.
We'll take more questions in just a bit.
Yeah, just to show this one, it's kind of the opposite of what we're seeing. Well, the higher density counts were within the city. Now we see the darker grids, right, on the edges, on the outside, like even out of state in New Jersey, because makes sense, the further you go, the higher the taxi cab fare, right? So just different ways to visualize the aggregation data and big data, which is pretty cool, yeah.
All right. Thanks, Ricardo.
Yep.
So I'm going to walk us through a couple other sections, and then we'll take more questions after this, because I want to make sure we get through this. This is important knowledge for you guys to have. So we're going to take a little bit of a deeper dive into some of the configuration options that we glossed over before. So for data reliability, when you're dealing with a NoSQL cluster like our big data store is, it's span across multiple machines. And so there's this option called replication factor. So per data source or per layer that you define in the spatial temporal big data store, you can define the replication factor. Typically, you would leave this to 1. And what 1 means is anytime I write to one data node, I would also write to another data node in the big data store. That way, if the drive fails on the primary node, then the secondary node would take it over and you would lose data. Circumstances where you might do something other than 1 is if you didn't care if you lost the data, you could set it to 0. You get better write throughput and you get better performance out of your big data store because instead of writing 2 things, we'd just be writing 1 thing. Circumstance where you might want to increase it is if the data is static and it's not going to change and you're willing to take the hit on the load time, then if you put replication factor higher, you're going to get even faster map service response time because you'll get more hits on different nodes that normally wouldn't have that data. So you can play around with the replication factor if you've got static data and increase that number to see if it helps performance if you need more performance. It's already pretty performant the way it is. So the replication factor, just to illustrate this, if I had a replication factor of 1 and a cluster of 5 nodes, when I wrote track 1, I would write the primary to 1 data node, and I would write the secondary to another data node. So these are all internal details just so you have better knowledge of what's under the hood. So when you configure this, you configure it with more intelligence. So there's a primary and a secondary for track 1. We'd write track 2. We'd write track 3. If there's a failure on node 1 and node 1 fails and it had the primary for track 1 and the secondary for track 3, we need to have a replication factor of 1 for track 1. And there's only a secondary at this point. So the secondary on node 4 becomes the primary, and then we establish another secondary node. It doesn't matter which node takes it as long as some other node has it. And then we need the secondary for track 3 to be reestablished. So all that's automatic. You don't have to configure anything. It just happens and works. So when you define a replication factor, we take care of that along with all the open source stuff that we're leveraging underneath. The other thing, which was an unfortunate oversight when we released the initial 10.4 version of this, is that there's this thing called rolling data option. And so what rolling data option specifies is with this very big data, we don't want to have one index that's for all of the data. We want to have many small indexes that we can hit. And so the indexes, since this is a spatial temporal store, are based on time. So the indexes are temporally oriented, and this rolling data option allows you to specify how often they roll, which means how often we create new indexes. So a very unfortunate circumstance that was an oversight at 10.4 was this was set to yearly, which means if you start rocking and rolling with the big data store tomorrow, you go back home, and then a couple weeks later, you're like, damn, my map service is slow. Why is it so slow? It's because this one gigantic index is building up and you've got a massive amount of data, and so we're struggling to search across the same index. So at 10.4.1, we changed the default to daily. If your data is not changing that often, you could specify weekly, but yearly is certainly not a great option to default with. So daily is what's changed at 10.4.1. There's a patch for this at 10.4 if you need to stay on 10.4 that you can apply to do that, or just make sure that you change the default to daily. So be aware of that. It was engineering oversight, again, because we decided to release the big data store very late in the 10.4 cycle. So that's why we didn't have a proper UI for installation, and we had an oversight like this. Another thing is there's also, I think in 10.4.1, an option called shards. And so shards are how many times we partition the data across the big data store node. So the best practice for shards as a default is the number of data nodes that you have. So if you increase the number of data nodes, you can adjust your shards. That way we're sharding the data across n number of data nodes. So if you see a property called shards, that's what that is. Just if you don't want to mess with it, keep it the same number of the data nodes that you have. Another one, and this is where the prize is, so we'll see who was listening in my last session. There's this object ID option. And so object IDs are kind of interesting because the rest of the ArcGIS stack deals with int32 object IDs. So int32, and we default this to int64 for a reason that we'll go through here. So int32 has a max value of 2.1 billion, which sounds like a big number. But when you're working in a real-time space, if you're getting 1,000 events per second, you're going to run out of IDs in 25 days. So this obviously won't work too well for a real-time system that's generating lots of data. So we default to int64 as part of the big data store. And what that means is, you know, okay, you're rocking and rolling again. You've set it to daily instead of yearly. You're doing good. A month later, you get into the system and you try to load the feature service or the map service into Pro or ArcMap, and it has a challenge loading, or otherwise known as crashes. And so you can't explain why does it keep crashing. Well, you're encountering object IDs that are bigger than int32. So that's just something else to be aware of. There's techniques to regenerate the object IDs and start them back over at zero, and there's all kinds of techniques that you can do for that if you really need to use ArcMap or Pro. The good news is JavaScript and the web client, all of our web clients support int64 signed, and they actually support a UUID string, which is another option that you can specify here. So the prize is, who can tell me what that number is? What's the unit? Whoever shouts it first gets this cool cup. What is it? No? Quintillion. Yeah, got it. All right, that's close. Yeah, so quintillion. Awesome. Always like to keep the sessions interesting, right? Give away a prize, people stay, right? All right, so that's quintillion. So that's a big number that I had to look up. You guys are a lot smarter than me. So N64, you're going to run out in like 292 million years. So hopefully I'm not alive by that time, I hope. So I think we're in pretty good shape there. There's also a unique string ID if you really want to make sure you never run out of IDs. So maybe you're anticipating that, you know, you're going to be getting hundreds of millions of events per second. Maybe in 3 years our problems are that size, which could be with all these IoT devices. Mm-hmm. So it could be a problem that we encounter. So we have this unique string ID that is unbounded. So it's a UUID strategy, a GUID. So, okay, with that, we're going to shift into what's coming at 10.5. And this is a very short section. I think we have time to show you a sneak peek demo of it.
Okay.
Are we still good to show the demo? Okay. And then we'll take questions. So the BDS-specific enhancements that we're doing for 10.5 is we're going to get even better geo-performance improvements. So there's been a lot of work underneath what we're doing, both in the open source community as well as the work that we're doing on top of it to improve the performance better. Part of that has been improving performance for lines and polygons and those kinds of things as well, so which might put us in a shape to be able to do general polygon aggregation in the future. I don't know that that'll come at 10.5, but it's something we're actively working on as an R&D project. We're enhancing the config UI so that it includes the big data store as an option. You saw that screenshot earlier. That was from a daily setup that we had. And then the two other big things is a lot of our enterprise customers say, you know, the replica is great, but I want more assurance that you're not going to lose my data. So there's a capability that we're going to enable on the big data store that allows us to snapshot the entire state of the data across the cluster. And so that can be configured every day, every hour, such that we have a snapshot of the entire data that you could restore back from. And so when we snapshot, the first snapshot will take some time, and then every other snapshot is an incremental snapshot. So then you could pick where you want to restore from, and then we say restore from this point yesterday, and all of your data in the big data store would be back to that point. So that's obviously going to need a big place to put that data, because if I've got five machines with 3 terabyte disks on them that are almost full, and I do a snapshot, that's a big place to put data. So you're not going to just go put that on your laptop. You're going to put that on S3, Azure Blob Storage, or or a network file share that has enough capacity for that. The admin will also have the ability to set a data retention policy. So a lot of the questions we get about big data store is, how do I know how many nodes I need? So there's capacity planning exercise that we go through with folks to help them identify that. But what they want to know once we've gone through that exercise is that they can be assured that if I'm getting 1,000 events per second that are a kilobyte each and I want to keep 6 months worth of data around, you told me four nodes is big enough for that. I want to make sure that I'm not storing more than a month's worth of data. So we need to be able to set retention policies. I wish relational databases had this capability. But when the data fills up and after a month, we will purge all of the data older than that out, and we'll give you the option to export that data out before we purge it so you don't lose it. So we could export out to various mechanisms like HDFS or Parquet files on S3 or whatever format you want. If you have ideas for formats, we're prioritizing that list. So tell me your ideas in our Q&A or after the session. We're also adding support for tables. So a lot of the real-time data that we work with is not moving observations, but it's sensor observations, things that aren't moving, but their geometries are staying the same, but their attributes are changing all the time. So gas and electric distribution networks with pressure valve sensors and those kinds of things. So we're going to add support for tables inside of the big data store, and a table will have a related feature with it that would have the geometry aside next to it. That way we're not storing the same geometry over and over again for the sensor observations. We can store it once, and then if somebody moves it or whatever, then all the historic ones have the right location going forward in the future. We also are spending a bit of time, which was the two catalysts for us building the spatial temporal big data store, was to solve the write throughput problem from the real-time system and also to enable a input and output location for big data analytics. And so GeoAnalytics server is a key stakeholder of the spatial temporal data store, not only for being able to load data into the big data store from data sources like folders of delimited text files like Ricardo was showing. It's kind of overkill to feed a CSV file through GeoEvent to put it in the big data store. So it'd be nice if you had a tool in your portal or a tool in Pro that you could just say, GeoAnalytics tool, load data into the big data store, and it would go load that data in appropriately, and it would do the throttling, and it would do everything that's appropriate for it. You also can analyze an external data source like Hadoop or HDFS and do analysis on it and then write the results back to the big data store. The reason why the results are written back to the big data store as opposed to writing it back to Hadoop is that if we wrote it back to Hadoop, you'd have no way to visualize it or work with it in the ArcGIS system. So if we write it into the big data store, we then have map services and feature services and other things that we can work with that data with and then do incremental analysis on it, maybe feed it into a small data analytic tool that's within ArcMap. And then also read from BDS and write back to BDS as a primary workflow. As we let the cat out of the bag earlier, we are enhancing the map service to do square and hexagon aggregation on the fly as well. So that's what Ricardo's going to show us a demo of here in a second. We've been working on, it's on the fence of making 10.5 or not, a server-side heat map aggregation as well. So if you wanted to look at the raw features and generate a heat map on the server side for billions of observations, you could start to do that. And our R&D project is continuing for general polygon aggregation. This is an example of the feature service. So the feature service will be enhanced such that you can ask it for an aggregation response as opposed to the raw features. And we also will enhance the feature service to support the operations that doesn't currently support at 10.4, like delete, add, and update. We initially did that by design because we didn't think people would want to edit the data that's in here because it's observation data and it's like cells in a film strip, but people didn't like that analogy and said, no, I really want to go change the cell in the film strip, so we're giving you delete, add, and update because you guys requested it. I'm not sure what the use cases are other than fixing errors or something, but we're adding that. So with that, we are at the 60-minute mark, so I think we have 5 minutes to show you the demo. Can you do it in 5 minutes?
Yeah, let's do it.
And then we'll leave plenty of time for Q&A.
Okay, so here's our here's our previous map. So like Adam mentioned, at 10.5, what we're doing is when you create a new data source, we had that section here called geohashing styles. So this is important when you create your new data source.
And just to qualify, this is not the end user interface.
This
is like a daily build.
Sneak peek at it. Things might change. but what we're doing is we're defaulting the data source to add three additional styles to your map at creation time. And this is important because at creation time, we also index the data with these proper styles. And what's important here is also the spatial reference well-known ID. Why? Like Adam, I think, mentioned earlier that since we are using the geohashing convention of the grids that we show, geohash is a standard that uses the geographic coordinate system, so WGS84. So every time we were showing the map earlier, we were reprojecting the bins. They look okay, but the closer you get to the poles, you can see they're longer rectangles and they don't look uniformed, right? And as someone else mentioned, they're not squares, they're rectangles. Well, why is that important? So with the hexagons and of course squares, if we were doing that same technique, you would see distortion on the hexagons, on the poles. So we had to add this option so you can tell us what is your target map. Most users would just use the standard web API, so the web Mercator is probably good enough. But if you wanted other coordinate system support, you can simply just add them. Or maybe you're not even going to bother with hexagons or squares. You can just delete them because this does affect the write time as well. So when you write data, this will affect it somewhat.
We'll do additional indexing for triangles that make up the hexagons.
Yep. So that's why this section is important. I wanted to go over that. So right now I didn't have to do anything when I created the data source. I didn't do anything, and I added, and it added these three automatically for me. So once I did that, when I go to create a map service, I've already created three to show you guys, so we don't have to wait for the publishing. But when I create one, so if I copy this one, in the aggregation style, the dropdown knows you've published this data source with those additional hexagon styles, geohash styles. So it knows you can select the render accordingly. So like for this one, we'll do flat hexagon. And then if you had multiple spatial reference well-known IDs, you can say that's the one I want to target there.
So flat just indicates the orientation of the hexagon if it's vertical, or I think pointy is vertical, right?
Yeah, so flat is horizontal, a horizontal hexagon. Pointy is a vertical hexagon, and then squares.
Again, all subject to change.
Yeah.
Pointy is a developer's idea.
Right.
Probably not what we'll call it in the end.
Yeah. So this is, I published the map services while Adam was speaking a little earlier, so we don't have to wait for my laptop to publish them. But here's a flat hexagon. Same concepts apply, right? So as we zoom in and out, we recalculate the aggregations. Pretty cool, right?
Yeah, the data is like not cleansed very well.
I just loaded that data. Probably need to do some cleansing and here's the pointy hexagons as well. Like I mentioned, I think we're dealing with an orientation problem too, so we have to fix this issue before we release.
Yeah, it's like adjusted.
I think if you can see the density is not in the city now. I think it's not adjusted properly, but
daily
sneak peek, work in progress. Yeah, just to show you guys the idea that we'll be able to support these.
Well, now it's all in the water.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on.
Bug discovered.
And then square, so the importance of the square, if you wanted the uniform squares versus the rectangles, here's the square. They're uniform now.
Yeah, there is some taxis in the water, but not that many. So
yeah, no.
There's a bug.
I mean, okay. That was our original data. Yeah, that's it. That's the sneak peek there. And we'll work on that.
Okay, so I'm not going to summarize because I just want to leave enough time for a Q&A. So any questions or feedback that you guys have? I'll go on the back first. That's a great question to go ask. The question was, why do we require Portal for the Spatial Temporal Big Data Store? What's the business reason behind it? So that's a great question to go ask the Portal and server guys, specifically Jay Theodore and Sud Menon. I'd like to know the answer too. Yes, here in the middle. So the question is, are we looking at integrating with the utility network and aggregating on the utility network itself? So we work really closely with Eric Howell and his team because he's got a sub-team that does the geoanalytics stuff as well. So we're very much in touch with what they're doing as well and hope to have this work in that capacity as well. So we can aggregate really anything. So it doesn't matter if it's on a utility network or if it's moving assets or whatever it is. So, yeah, good point.
I noticed you don't seem to have a connector for JDBC, so you know, if you're wanting to move data out of a relational database into the big data store, and you can use Elasticsearch or something like that, pipe it through Rabbit, but I didn't know if there was a reason you didn't talk to JDBC directly.
Yeah, so the comment is it'd be nice if we had a JDBC connector to be able to move data from relational databases I have today into the big data store. So, yeah, I think that's one of those that we didn't list here, but it's on the cuff of maybe making 10.5 is general JDBC connectivity or ODBC connectivity, so that GeoAnalytics and its load capability, in addition to folders of delimited text, shapefiles, and HDFS and Hive, could support general database connectivity. So, yeah, that's good feedback. Thanks. Yeah, so the comment or the question is when we throttled in the file stuff, so if we had bursty data, does that mean the GeoVent could lose data? Potentially. So there's queue depths that we specify, and you can increase those as configuration settings. So if you do work with very bursty data, there's settings that you can adjust so that we can limit the option of that happening. But in general, GeoVent's not the best thing to use for very bursty data. So if you're getting 10 million things once an hour, GeoVent's not a very good use case for that, at least now the way it stands at 10.4. We are doing work to be able to handle bursty data going forward in a better way. But a lot of like satellite observations and stuff come in, like here's 200,000 things every 1 minute or every 5 minutes. We work quite well with those kinds of use cases. We just have to tune it properly for that. Yeah. All right. Yes. So the question is, what's the relationship between the output that we create here and the space-time cubes? It's interesting because one of my guys on my team actually did an R&D project to do space-time cube aggregation on the fly, but we haven't really taken it further than just the R&D phase. So, but that's an interesting question, yeah. We're still trying to figure that out ourselves. So can we produce NetCDF and other things that people can consume in real time with NetCDF things building up? So it's an R&D project at this point. We haven't committed to anything yet.
But would you be able to do it from a snapshot of view? I mean, from the data, so is that part of GeoAnalytics?
Yes. Yeah, so the question is it part of GeoAnalytics that you can do the space-time cubes? So it can create space-time cubes using the big data store data as input, yeah. Yes. Yeah. So the comment was the best practices we put, I'm just repeating it for the recording. We talked about putting a message bus in front of GeoVent to scale it out. Would that be another way to handle bursty data? That's exactly how we're going to address it in the future. Yeah.
Would you release some recipes or sort of ideas on how to do that?
Yeah, so the question is, can we release recipes or ideas on how to do that? So I think we're forming a white paper that would kind of talk through that scenario as well as a reference implementation that we'll likely put on GitHub that would be a starter pack for people to do that kind of thing. Yeah, good feedback. Yes?
You mentioned configuring the rolling data options so that the index over time doesn't grow too large.
Yeah, so the question is around the rolling data option. What's the right setting if I'm working with data that reaches over 2, 3, 4, 5 years? So small indexes are fine. There's just going to be a lot of them that we hit. So if you're looking over 5 years, it's totally reasonable to have a cluster to do that. Depending on the velocity and the volume of your data, it might be a quite large cluster to store that amount of data. A lot of our customers are looking to use the spatial temporal big data store as a hot cluster that they can do hot analysis on. So they might have one spatial temporal big data store cluster that's hot that has local SSDs, so you can get super fast answers. So that might be like the first year's worth of your data. And then they stand up another spatial temporal big data store cluster that's a warm cluster that's on spinning disks. It's much cheaper that they can put a lot more number of them on. So they don't have to incur all the hardware cost of that. So that's a pattern that we're seeing a lot of people do right now. At 10.4 and 10.5, it won't be possible to have more than one spatial temporal big data store cluster at a time. Beyond 10.5, we're looking to add that capability so we can have hot, warm, cold, other types of things. And then beyond warm, people would typically put into like Amazon Glacier or Azure Data Lake or HDFS if you had that on, in your own environment. Yeah, good question. Yes.
So, can you recommend any techniques or ways to generate summary reports from the big data store? Someone just wanted to generate a text report.
Yeah, so the...
What
recommendation would we have for somebody to generate like a dashboard or a summary report of what's going on in the big data store? So we haven't done as well of a job as we wanted to, but our plan is to expand that spatial temporal big data store page to actually have like a monitoring dashboard and stuff to know how many data sources you have, how many indexes they've created, how long the data lasts, what's the average writes per second per data source, those types of things. So right now, the recommendation would be to talk to us offline, and we can talk about if you're wanting to build a vertical solution or an add-on solution beyond what we provide as a distributor type of product or whatever. We could give you the right hooks to be able to hook into those diagnostics to be able to build that kind of thing. Yeah. Is that what you're thinking? Something like that? Yeah. All right. Last question. So the question is, can I aggregate by like a polyline? So tell me the taxis that were on this route. So I think the best answer to that would be employing the GeoAnalytics server and doing a spatial join, and that would be the technique to do that. So the spatial join would allow you to join data. You might first have to go through network snapping or something to get it onto the route. Or at least give it a tolerance, but spatial join would probably be the best way to look at that. So talk to the folks in that booth or talk to us offline. We know those tools well, too. All right. Thank you for your time. Enjoy the rest of the conference.